You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 24th of May 2023 on Monocle Radio.
The Republican Party's presidential nomination has a new hat in the ring. Ukraine's foreign minister takes the baton from Ukraine's president as the international charm relay continues, and relief for the patient waiting list of one California library. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests are Sasha Dovzhik and Charles Hecko will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll hear from CNN's Nick Peyton-Walsh about his extraordinary report on the migrants walking one of Earth's most dangerous routes. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Charles Hecker, senior partner at Control Risks, currently on leave to write a book about international business in Russia, and by Sasha Dovzhik, special projects curator at the Ukrainian Institute in London, also an associate lecturer in Ukrainian at University College London. Hello to you both.
Good evening.
Sasha, first of all, you have recently been visiting your homeland, which is obviously not the straightforward undertaking it might have been about 18 months ago. Which parts of it were you visiting?
That's right. I went to Kyiv, which is the capital, obviously, and I also went for a short volunteer's trip to the east of the country, to the territories which have been recently liberated by the Ukrainian army or which are right on the front line of the current invasion. So it was Donetsk and Kharkiv regions. Not the most pleasant May trip one could imagine, but I suspect it was useful.
Well, indeed. But what I'm wondering, and I do know that often with an ongoing conflict, actually getting close to it is probably the least informative view you can have. It's often very hard to know what is going on when you're in the middle of it. But that notwithstanding, what sense were you able to get of how things are progressing?
Well, when you wake up from an explosion right next to you, I think you get the general sensation of what it means to live close to the front line. I was just really struck by what people have been going through for almost 15 months. Mm. It's a really tense situation over there, but people are incredibly resilient and the morale is high.
Well, we will be returning to that subject later in the show. Charles, I realize, and our listeners will realize by now, that this is becoming something of a running gag, but how is the book going?
Today was a very big day, Andrew. I interviewed...
20 words, 30?
I interviewed two whole people.
Wow.
Two very important business people with long and illustrious backgrounds in business in Russia, and had a very, very productive few hours with both of them.
Oh, well, that's good to know, because I know from my own experience that dedicated book writing days often end with about 45 words and a really clean kitchen. Like the tops of the cupboards, you know, everything.
My apartment has never been cleaner. I'm with you on that. I feel your pain.
Well, we will start the show proper with official confirmation of what has been long suspected, that barring some unforeseen deliverance, the contest for the Republican Party's nomination for President of the United States will be between two Florida men, in every sense of the phrase. As Ron DeSantis, governor of the and finally state, formally hurls his gauntlet at the feet of Mar-a-Lago landlord Donald Trump. Oddly, DeSantis has chosen to make his announcement via the Spaces facility of Twitter, i.e. an obscurish part of a social media platform barely a fifth of Americans even use, and those who do tend Democrat. Ahead of the highly anticipated announcement, DeSantis released a teaser video.
They call it faith because in the face of darkness, you can see that brighter future. A faith that our best days lay ahead of us. But is it worth the fight? Do I have the courage? Is it worth the sacrifice? America has been worth it every single time.
Charles, you can sit down and stop saluting. What did you make of that?
Wow. So I guess this is finally now the merging of politics and entertainment, something that the United States has been hurtling towards over the past several decades. And I think we're now on a collision course.
Sasha, there are two questions hanging over Ron DeSantis's candidacy. Ron DeSantis is a cant. Imagine trying to say a phrase with that many S's in it on the radio, and it's only Wednesday. There are two questions, Sasha. One, can he beat Donald Trump? And then two, can he beat Donald Biden? Joe Biden's the other one. It's easy to get them mixed up. Can he beat Donald Trump and can he beat Joe Biden?
I'd prefer to take a back seat here and to delegate this question to our honorary guest.
What do you think, Charles?
So he's really, you know, he is throwing down the gauntlet here. And what he's going to have to do to beat Donald Trump is he's going to have to take him on head on. And he's going to have to directly attack the president and attack his records. And this is going to be a very difficult thing to do because you will never alienate the 35% of Republicans who form their base, whose vote you absolutely must garner to win the nomination. And so he's going to have to walk a very fine line. What he has, though, with today's announcement is the support of Elon Musk. Musk has endorsed DeSantis.
Is this good?
Well, so good question. What it does is it ties DeSantis to Musk, not just until this November, but until next November. And what we know about Elon Musk is that what he giveth, he also taketh away. And so it's a risky strategy. He has the endorsement of a serious player in social media. How you maintain that endorsement and how you shape your candidacy and your campaign around another individual's priorities is super tricky.
Sasha, how important, though, are the optics of either of those potential contests going to be, DeSantis versus Trump, DeSantis versus Biden? Because the one thing he will have going for him, and what I'm interested in is this actually an asset? He is literally nearly half the age of both men. He's 44.
It helps, actually. The optics are such that DeSantis seems like he's not falling apart. This can't hurt, right? But the thing that worries us on the Ukrainian side is his rhetoric and his pro-Russian leanings. But the thing that we can actually hope for is that your position determines your worldview. So now he's a candidate and he will obviously be critical of democratic support for Ukraine. But once and if he becomes the president, this will change because Ukraine currently enjoys this bilateral support in America, and he will be obliged to go by the will of the people. And as far as I know, the will of the people in America is to continue supporting Ukraine in this fight.
Is there, just to follow that up, though, much nervousness in Ukraine? I mean, I know we're 18 months out from the U.S. presidential election, but you know, as you are aware, and as I'm sure Ukrainians are aware, this has become, like everything else in American politics, a culture war touchstone. There are conservative Republicans putting it about that, you know, supporting Ukraine is in some measure treacherous, un-American, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
They would say so, I suppose, to shift the public opinion in their favor so that they do not sound like they are aligned with the democratic forces, right? They have to debate over something. In Ukraine, it is quite weird. We feel as if we've become this bet in a game. And for us, obviously, it's not a game. It's the life and death situation. And we feel this pressure to basically win the genocidal war before the American election, which is not the way this question should be framed.
Well, indeed not. Charles, is DeSantis also backing on the fact that he can pitch himself to Republican voters, and it is debatable how many of them are swayed by logic, especially that 35% rock-solid base you mentioned. But the thing he would appear to have going for him is the fact that there is no imaginable Republican path to the White House that does not include Florida. And DeSantis is a winner in Florida. The last gubernatorial election, he won by a street.
That's right. He won the Florida governor's office by an absolute landslide. And so he takes, I believe, what is the fourth most populous state with a big chunk of electoral votes with him into the general election, assuming that he gets there. What he's got to do first, though, I mean, the American system's quite unusual, and that is that he's got to pitch to primary voters. And primary voters are very different from the people who cast ballots in a general election. He's going to have to go harder to the right, mm-hmm. which will alienate the country club Republicans. He's going to have to be Trumpy without being Trump. Which is going to alienate anybody who's a moderate and thinking of switching parties. And then once he gets through the primaries, and if he gets through the primaries, he's going to have to slam on the brakes and rush towards the center to try to get the moderate vote.
And Sasha, just finally, Donald Trump, his likely opponent, has been workshopping a couple of nicknames for Ron DeSantis. He's floated Meatball Ron and Ron de Sanctimonious. Do you think either of those are going to stick?
Does not sound too appealing to me. De Sanctimonious sounds very Victorian, though.
I wonder if that might have two or three too many syllables in it for the Trump crowd.
It doesn't trip lightly off the tongue, does it?
It does not. It's no low energy Jeb.
No, that worked quite well, didn't it? Yeah.
We will move along to Ukraine, and the recent peregrinations of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky have demonstrated an understanding that while the case for defending Ukraine is understood to be self-evident by the United States, almost all of Europe, and most of the wider West, attitudes are more equivocal elsewhere. Hence Zelensky's appearance at the Arab League summit in Jeddah and the G7 meeting in Hiroshima. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has now tapped in and is in Morocco, beginning his second tour of Africa. Before leaving, Kuleba spoke at a joint press conference with his counterpart, Nasser Barita.
We also agreed with Nasser today to make very specific steps in order to facilitate trade and people-to-people contacts between our countries. Therefore, we agreed to hold consultations on visa facilitation and trade facilitation between Ukraine and Morocco. All of this is taking place against the background of the war. And I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to the government of Morocco for the support it has extended to Ukraine on the international stage, particularly at the United Nations General Assembly, where Morocco voted for very important resolutions aimed at restoring peace in Ukraine.
Dmytro Kuleba, Foreign Minister of Ukraine, speaking earlier. Sasha, this has been a bit of a developing theme over, I think, the last 6 months or so, this understanding that the United States, most of Europe, instantly, almost instinctively reacted to support Ukraine, saw this as an absolutely clear-cut, black and white, open and shut injustice, who would not support Ukraine, and then turns around and realizes that quite a lot of, you know, the phrase the Global South is not one everybody's happy with, but quite a lot of the Global South was standing there going, well, what's this got to do with us? How big a part of the conversation in Ukraine has that become?
It's becoming more and more important in Ukraine and in global conversation about Ukraine and about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think this is right, because since Ukraine gained its independence in 1991, its diplomatic efforts were mostly directed towards the West. Mm. And in the meantime, Russia spread its influence globally. And it's been strengthening its presence on the African continent in particular for the past 70 years. There are 40 Russian embassies in Africa, which is four times as much as Ukraine has. And this is obviously the question of resources. Russia has never had any limits imposed on itself when it comes to spreading propaganda or disinformation. And now we see the fruits of this spending, right? On the African continent, the disinformation about Ukraine is quite like it's a wash in disinformation. However, the stakes are very high for Africa because Ukraine has been a stable supplier of grain and of the other agricultural produce to the continent. And currently Russia is just exploiting in the informational sphere the crisis of its own creation. Russia has famously blocked Ukrainian sea exports through the Black Sea, and it tries to lay the blame for the lack of food security in Africa on Ukraine. And it is our job now to show where the blame really lies, that it lies with Russia, as always.
I will at this point insert a clanging plug for the current edition of the Foreign Desk, which does take a long, hard look at why three key countries, specifically Brazil, South Africa and Saudi Arabia, won't get off the fence where Ukraine is concerned. But Charles, what difference would it make if any or all of them did and perhaps bought their regions along with them?
So it's just so interesting to see Africa crisscrossed by different diplomatic delegations and not just from Russia and Ukraine, but also from the United States and from the European Union, sort of buttressing the arguments that are coming from Dmytro Kuleba and other diplomats from Ukraine. And just I'll throw in also, you see the same thing happening around the world in Southeast Asia, where everybody's competing for influence in terms of a resistance, if you will, to China. You know, if Africa were to back one or the other of the parties in this conflict, I mean, I think the first thing that you want to see happen is that if South Africa has been sending weapons to Russia, and if, you know, diplomacy is successful on behalf of Ukraine, you would see that stop. You might see more votes in the UN. You might see more votes on the Security Council. You might see a little bit more tolerance of what's happening with, you know, if food prices spike again. You might see some financial support. You might see some military support. And you would just begin to see this engagement from African countries that heretofore, you know, this is somebody else's conflict or we're on the fence, you might say, actually, this is more meaningful to us than just a distant rivalry.
I mean, Sasha, I can well imagine it's the last thing Ukraine feels that it should have to keep in mind or should have to deal with. But what can Ukraine offer if just going out there and saying this is the right thing to do is not persuasive enough?
Well, we can offer food. This is quite essential, isn't it? Ukraine has this fantastic rich black soil. As we well know, it has the quarter of this black soil called Chornozem of the European continent. And it's been crucial for producing all sorts of like agricultural goods. And the African continent is reliant on that. So the food security of the globe is reliant upon the safety and security in Ukraine. So if we want to feed the global population, we definitely should invest into the resolving this war in Ukraine on Ukrainian terms. Apart from that, there has been like great educational exchange between Africa and Ukraine. In particular, Moroccan students used to come to Ukraine, and it was a fantastic what Kuleba calls people-to-people way of establishing like these bilateral relationships. And it would be fantastic to see all these students back in Ukraine to build this mutual understanding.
Charles, just finally on this, I know the United States has not been inactive in trying to corral Africa in particular, and indeed South America on this, but is there perhaps more they could be doing? Because rightly or wrongly, and this is a conversation I have had with quite a few by now European foreign ministers and indeed prime ministers, that this a self-consciousness does hang over them about going to Africa and trying to tell African countries, here's what you should be doing. There's a European conflict you should be taking sides in. And because obviously there is a historical baggage there, which I think in recent years in particular, European governments have become more conscious of, and probably not before time, but it does seem to make them a little more hesitant.
Well, exactly right. I mean, whether it's responses to European diplomats or responses to American overtures, many African countries have said, you know what, we've had some of our own conflicts around here these days.
And nobody showed up.
Right. Mm. And so, you know, you can leave us alone and stop dictating to us about which conflicts should matter to us because we're still recovering from decades of conflict that you gave us absolutely no help on. The other problem with the United States is that this this was a real spanner in the works of U.S. foreign policy because the Biden administration wanted to do nothing more than focus on China. And so the U.S. was initially on the back foot. You're right to point out that there was a coordinated response in the U.S. and the EU and the rest of the G7, but this was a distraction. And so to refocus on Africa and to refocus on Ukraine took some of the capacity out of the State Department that the United States would rather have seen focused elsewhere.
Well, let's look at another aspect of Ukraine. And Sasha, you mentioned there Ukraine's black soil. And while Russia's rampage in Ukraine is first and foremost a human disaster, it is also, as wars tend to be, an environmental one. Ukraine's Ministry for Environmental Protection and Natural Resources has attempted to put a figure on the damage done to Ukraine's natural environment so far and arrived at a sum in the vicinity of 200 billion euros. Line items on the bill include poisoned soil, contaminated rivers, toxic smoke, and leveled forests. Sasha, this seems at least like kind of a companion to these efforts Ukraine has also been making, and I think almost without precedent in the history of warfare, to chronicle war crimes in real time, to build the case as it goes along. Is this kind of initiative something we're seeing across all aspects of Ukraine's government?
Oh, definitely. Actually, the trip that I undertook to the east of Ukraine was part of this effort. We were documenting Russia's war crimes in the area. And the crimes against environment were part of that. When you go to the areas which have been devastated by the war, you see it with your own eyes. You can see the craters, thousands of them, which are from 3 to 15 meters in diameter, in this rich black soils. And these craters are from missiles. And what's left there from this missiles is poisoning the soil, poisoning the waters. The forests are erased by fire of war. And you can also, like 30% of Ukrainian territory is currently mined because of Russia's invasion. It will take decades, I suppose, to demine these territories and to return them into the fold. So there are activists, there are environmentalists who are documenting the damage on the ecosystems in Ukraine. And in particular, there are currently 15 criminal cases in Ukrainian courts which focus on the environmental damage of Russia's invasion. And they are currently awaiting decision. We keep waiting for that, and we plan to persist and to move towards international courts. There is currently there is the definition, the term ecocide that has been passed around. So probably this war in Ukraine will be the first war which will bring this new crime into the international law.
Which, Charles, when you think about the history of warfare, does seem quite overdue, because it is often the case that the environment is not an incidental target. It is, in fact, the target. One thinks probably most obviously of the United States' attempts to deforest Vietnam and one or two neighboring countries in the 1970s.
That's right. And some of the damage that's been done to the Ukrainian environment is not only just as a result of missiles, but Russia has intentionally mined agricultural land in Ukraine, rendering it completely useless. And when Sasha talks about the deep, rich black soil of Ukraine, that now is injected with explosives, rendering it, not just polluted, but lethal. And, you know, the problem is that if you were to try to hold Russia accountable for this, Russia has a recent history of completely ignoring judgments made by foreign courts, including internationally recognized courts. And if Russia were ever to, acknowledge, let alone compensate for the damage that it's done to the Ukrainian environment, we would be talking about a dramatically different Russia than the one that we see now.
Well, indeed. So, Sasha, you are from Zaporizhia, a city which has acquired a prominence it obviously didn't want over the last 15 months due to the presence of a huge nuclear plant there. Do you feel like, though, and is Ukraine's view, do you think, that Russia, as well as engaging in ecocide, as you suggested, pursuing a strategy of a sort of environmental blackmail, as in everybody understands, and again, this is something Ukraine learned the hard way in 1986, the damage that can be done by a disaster at a nuclear plant?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. My city is now famous for all the wrong reasons. Russia occupied the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in March last year, and since then it was the object of military aggression. There has been military equipment stored on the premises. Russia is actually the first country in history to occupy an object of civilian nuclear infrastructure. This is unprecedented. And this is one of the crimes that Russia has responded for. And indeed, Russia has used nuclear blackmail and has used this occupation of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant as a kind of leverage in this war. But I think this brings us back to the question of Russia's impunity. Russia's impunity has been an established fact. Russia has never been punished for its crimes. And I think that this war in Ukraine will be its last war. Finally, we'll have to solve this question of Russia's impunity and bring justice to the survivors of Russia's war crimes.
Sasha and Charles, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you shortly. But now, amid the Pan American Highway, which links Alaska to Argentina, are 66 missing miles. This is the infamous Darien Gap between Colombia and Panama, which had acquired a certain cachet among devil-may-care hikers, willing to test themselves against such hazards as rain, mud, jungle, spiders, snakes, and militant guerrilla groups. The Darien Gap is presently being plodded by people whose motivations are more urgent, migrants trying to get themselves from South America or the Caribbean to the United States. CNN's chief international security correspondent Nick Payton-Walsh recently walked the Darien Gap alongside them. I spoke to Nick earlier and I began by asking if it was possible to generalize about who was walking the Darien Gap and why.
I think the simplest generalization, and everybody's unique and different and escapes the kind of umbrella thoughts you'd like to have, but all in all, these are very desperate people who are pushed into this extraordinarily dangerous task, this remarkable series of hazards for them, for their children, for their frail loved ones, by sometimes political reasons, a lot of it's economic desperation. A lot of it, I think, now is hard in this modern world to differentiate between where one begins and one ends. And you are totally blown away by the sheer grit and fuel behind their desire to go through this physical torture. And sometimes the risk of robbery, murder, sexual assault over days. And then after the jungle trek itself is finished, the weeks ahead to get further up towards the US border. I was utterly astonished by how people must see no way behind them other than going forward.
It is important to keep in mind that for many of them, this is really only the beginning or at least an early stage of that journey. But you mentioned there the difficulty of the trek, and you walked the route yourselves, the CNN team. It's about 112 kilometers, which is a decent stretch over 5 or 6 days anyway. But this really isn't just a stroll, is it? This is a proper slog.
I mean, this is physically exceptionally hard for our team, who had all the best gear that you could possibly buy, who had prepared for it, who had the food, who had porters helping us carry our stuff. This, for me, was just absolutely exhausting. And by the end of day five, my feet were literally peeling off my legs. So this is exceptionally difficult, not just because of the heat of the jungle and the incredible lengths you're going through, but a lot of this is trudging through water. It's not refreshing or fun. It's exhausting. And a lot of this is over rocks that are very difficult. And it's not just because this gets irritating after a while, staring down at your feet constantly to make sure you don't twist your ankle. It's that if you do injure yourself on these rocks, then you're potentially stuck there, particularly if you don't have the scale of team that we did to be able to help each other out. So this is an exceptionally hard thing. And that's, you just put aside the food absences, how getting clean water is difficult, snakes, all the other potential problems the jungle brings.
With any movement of people or any gathering of people, especially one of this size, an economy, a regime, something does tend to develop around it. Is there any sense of organization imposed or developed from within this thing? Is there any kind of order at all?
Well, there's two things. There's the incredible generosity of the crowd, of the migrants themselves to each other, which shines through all the time. And that's a kind of organization because it's a basic base level of decency, which nobody seems to want to slip below. But there is a much darker, bigger organization behind all of it. This whole thing is run by a cartel whose major other income is drug trafficking. And this is to some degree possibly becoming more profitable, becoming easier. You don't risk going to prison as much if you assist people to make a long trek. These people will pay for the privilege, and these people run the risk entirely themselves. And so a lot of this is being run by sophisticated cartels. They want you to see how organized they are. They want you to see the efforts they make up to a point to assist people on their side of the border in Colombia. And so, yeah, this is a trade.
Is it necessary for journalistic purposes, either before or during, to interact with the cartel in any respect at all?
They provided us permission to be on that walk, and we're left speculating as to why they did that. We, on the walk itself, met a number of their local guides who are not in themselves hostile individuals. I mean, they're members of an unpleasant organization, certainly, but they are there to keep as much order as they can, to be organized, and to provide at times people advice. At the beginning, there was a sort of slightly oddly religious feel about how people were being corralled. There were religious songs being played. That was part, it seemed, of the effort to build people's courage and energy levels up ahead of the beginning of the walk. But at the same time, too, the cartel guides were saying, don't rush, the last will be first, and trying to encourage people's generosity to each other. And even at 1.2, when they weren't happy that it seemed some theft had occurred in the crowd, they came over the loudspeaker and said, give back that wallet or no one's going anywhere.
The story is, of course, first and foremost about the people who are undertaking this trek. And when you think of the people that you met on this walk, are there any that stuck in your head particularly?
Yeah, there was a tiny kid from Haiti, and he'd been separated from his parents. As part of the normal, I say normal, but as part of what's sort of an established routine on this. And he was given by his parents to a porter because they're heavy to carry kids. They can't always make the walk themselves. But the porter races off ahead because he knows the route, and the parents are left far behind. And so we met him. He was very cheerful, incredibly buoyant, but obviously a bit scared that his parents were way behind him. And he didn't really know whether he was going to actually have a chance to catch up with them. And yeah, that was extraordinary to see, because the idea you're bumping into a child who may not see his parents again because of how this trek functions was worrying. He was reunited with his parents a couple of days later. We saw a very sick child too, who began the trek really ill, got worse as time went by, and then appeared to recover as well. And these two kids were both from Haiti, and so many of those on that trek were Haitian. And the phenomenal persistence they showed, the resilience they showed, was quite incredible. These people doing the entire walk with a pair of flip-flops, one small backpack and a sports vest. And that just reminds you how incredibly difficult normal daily life in Haiti has become.
That was CNN's Nick Peyton Walsh speaking to me earlier. Nick's full report, which is entirely recommended, is available on CNN and on CNN's YouTube channel. We turn finally on today's Daily to the ethical dilemma recently confronted by a California man who, while going through some boxes of old books, disinterred a copy of Benson Lossing's 1881 work, A History of the United States, a short book at that point, which would have been marked as the property of St. Helena Public Library and was due back on February 21st, 1927. Possibly encouraged by the library's recent scrapping of late fines, which at 5 cents a day would have cleared $1,750, the honest citizen returned it, claiming it had been checked out by the grandfather of his late wife. A likely story. First of all, I did look this up. This is not the world record for the latest ever returned library book. The world record is 287 years. It was a German history book borrowed from Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge, in 1667 or so, by Colonel Robert Walpole, the father of Sir Robert Walpole, first Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, which was found by Walpole's biographer and returned. So both of you are safe from a world record in terms of not returning a library book, but do either of you have anything you want to confess to on this score?
I would like to spare a thought
for all of the people who submitted requests for these books, who desperately needed to read these books for a project they were working on, for a paper, for study, for school.
You think somewhere in the Napa Valley there's like some 140-year-old history enthusiast just going, God damn it.
You know, think of all of the people who are now heaving a huge sigh of relief because finally they can get their hands on this book that they sent a slip in for, you know, 50 years ago. I'm with all of those people right now.
Sasha, what about you? Do you have anything in your attic that you just don't want to face having to take back to a counter and explain, come up with some absurd cock and bull story about why you've held this book for 30 years?
I think, like, thanks to my MA in Victorian studies, I'm usually that person who comes into a charity bookshop and spots a book which is 150 years old and goes to the seller and's like, hey, you've got the first edition of Thackeray here, and then walks away into the sunset. But currently I'm one of those people who is waiting for a book that's been held by a reader at the UCL library for over a year. Dear reader, if you're holding Serhii Zhadan's translation of the orphanage. Please hear, hear.
They might be thinking 287 more years and I'm in the Guinness book. But have you ever actually found a first edition of Thackeray in a charity shop or anything of that sort?
I found not even one, but several first editions of Aubrey Beardsley, the turn of the century graphic designer and writer, which I reported to the seller of the bookshop.
Really?
Yeah.
Rather than just paying 50p for the lot and then bunging them on eBay.
I've got the first edition of Beardsley at home. Yeah. Which I bought for, I think, 10 quid at Oxfam. So, yeah.
That is a good day out at the Oxfam shop. Charles, have you ever accidentally disinterred something that turned out to be quite valuable? Clearly not that valuable, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here.
Nothing that I've been rushing to send to Sotheby's or to Christie's to put up on auction. I'm lucky when I find a couple of coins behind the cushions these days. So that's about the long and the short of it, I'm afraid.
Charles Hecker and Sasha Dovzhik, thank you both for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Daily. It was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Monica Lillis. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.